The headlines: Volodymyr Zelensky calls for more sanctions on Moscow, while the UN voices its commitment to Ukraine's integrity after people in four regions voted in favor of joining Russia. Israeli forces kill one more Palestinian man during an attack on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. And a powerful hurricane leaves a trail of destruction and causes a widespread blackout in Cuba before moving toward the U.S. state of Florida. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: the UN says it is fully committed to Ukraine's integrity after people in four Ukrainian regions voted in favor of joining Russia in five-day referendums.
Let me reiterate here that the United Nations remains fully committed to the sovereignty, unity, independence, and territorial integrity of Ukraine within its internationally recognized borders, in accordance with relevant UN resolutions.
Western countries have also condemned the vote as, quote, illegal and a sham, saying they will not accept the outcome. The U.S. says it will introduce a new resolution at the UN Security Council to call on member states not to recognize any altered status of Ukraine. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. said her country will also bring a vote to the U.N. General Assembly if Russia decides to veto it in the Security Council. Kiev has also reacted to the referendum, saying it will defend people in areas that have voted to join Russia. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has also called for more anti-Russia sanctions.
New and tough global sanctions against Russia are needed. Any annexations in the modern world are a crime against all states which consider the inviolability of borders to be vital for themselves.
Votes took place in the self-proclaimed republics of Luhansk and Donetsk in the east, as well as the Russian-controlled parts of Kherson and Zaporizhia. According to local authorities, vote tallies showed people saying yes to join Russia range from 87 to over 99%. The Kremlin previously vowed to protect the territories at all costs if they chose to become part of Russia. President Vladimir Putin is expected to formally declare the accession of four regions to Russia on Friday.
A voting station in central Donetsk. While Ukraine and NATO have condemned these referendums in the strongest terms, Russia and the local authorities are pushing on regardless.
It's kind of celebration for all of us today. Emotions are high. We've been waiting for it for many years, for 8 years. People are coming with positive emotions, with tears in their eyes.
I believe that besides providing us the opportunity to realize our future, it gives us guarantees of peace. This referendum gives us the chance finally to become again part of Russia, the country we were torn off from 30 years ago.
Now, while there is a palpable happiness and excitement amongst people here who are voting, it's important to recognize that in any referendum, legitimate or not, there are some who'll be happy about the results and some very unhappy. And so it's important to recognize that there is a minority of pro-Ukrainians here in Donbass, in particular in the Zaporizhia regions and the Kherson region. There are a large amount of Ukrainians who either won't vote today at a protest or who will vote no. And they particularly will be very unhappy that this referendum is taking place at all.
The fact that the world community doesn't recognize this referendum doesn't have big significance for us, because we, being people of Donbass, want to express our will. Our future depends on our actions and our interests. Let the world community hear our voices, and they'll have to recognize the results of this referendum, because our community, the people of Donbass, wish it to be this way.
While pro-Russians celebrate, for most Ukrainians and NATO, these events remain illegal and illegitimate. Johnny Millip, Donetsk.
Well, the European energy crisis keeps worsening. Slovakia's Prime Minister Eduard Heger says soaring power costs amid the ongoing Ukraine war leave his country's economy at the risk of collapse. Heger warned he would be forced to nationalize power supplies unless Bratislava received billions of euros in aid from the European Union. He also reiterated Slovakia's support for Ukraine despite the economic pain. Slovakia's economic growth has slowed while inflation has hit double digits. Russia supplied about 40% of European gas consumption before the Ukraine war. Russian gas flows are still running, but at severely reduced rates, pushing prices to record levels. Moscow says Eastern sanctions have hindered gas exports. European politicians say that's just a pretext, and Russia is using energy as a weapon. A major hurricane is expected to hit Florida, threatening to bring a deadly storm surge and more than a foot of rain to some areas.
You're going to see impacts all the way to the east coast of Florida. This thing's going to exit the state of Florida and most likely end up getting stronger, riding into the Atlantic, and then probably hitting Georgia, South Carolina, someplace like that. So this thing's the real deal. It is a major, major storm.
Over 2.5 million people in Florida are under some kind of evacuation order or warnings, with the sprawling storm on track to make landfall. Airlines canceled flights and electricity providers warned extended outages. Earlier, the storm hit Cuba. It left the entire country without power. Cuban authorities are just beginning to assess the damage. Meanwhile, analysts say the storm may get stronger and could be one of the costliest in the United States, as the latest simulations projected storm-related damages to be more than $60 billion. And a Palestinian man has been killed during a fresh Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Israeli troops reportedly surrounded a home belonging to the family of a Palestinian man who was killed by the regime back in April over an alleged shooting in Tel Aviv. They later fired a missile at the home, killing the brother of the slain Palestinian. The attack sparked clashes between Israeli forces and Palestinian resistance fighters. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 9 people were also injured during the latest Israeli aggression. The Jenin refugee camp has been a center of deadly Israeli raids for months. Tensions remain high across the West Bank as the regime has stepped up its crackdown there. According to Palestinian sources, regime forces have killed over 120 people in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip since the beginning of this year. Our correspondent Mona Candil is joining us now from Ramallah. Mona, please bring us up to speed on the recent Israeli violence that has occurred near the Jenin refugee camp once again.
As you have mentioned, Israeli troops revealed that, or the Israeli military revealed that, special forces raided refugee camp and encircled the house, the family house of Palestinian martyr Raad Khazem, who carried out an anti-Israeli operation back in April, leaving 3 Israeli soldiers dead and a number of Israelis were wounded. The Israelis said the main aim of this operation is to arrest the father of martyr Raad Khazem and his brother. However, confrontations took place between Palestinians who were inside the house and the Israeli soldiers that led to the killing of the brother of Raad Khazem, Abed, as well as another Palestinian. So 2 Palestinians were killed inside the house in the refugee camp of Jenin. The Palestinian ministry, the Palestinian Health Ministry also said that a 3rd Palestinian has been killed during the Israeli operation to Jenin when confrontations took place between Palestinians and Israeli forces in a nearby area, very close to the encircled house. A 3rd Palestinian was shot dead, and we are speaking about almost a dozen of Palestinians had been wounded. The Israeli military just now said its operation ended in the refugee camp of Jenin and started to pull out its troops from the refugee camp of Jenin. The Palestinians, of course, declared immediately mourning and a day of mourning, of course, for the 3 Palestinians that had been killed. So we are speaking about 3 Palestinians had been killed, the brother of martyr Raad Khazem and a 2nd Palestinian inside the house. A 3rd Palestinian was shot dead during the confrontations that took place between Palestinian fighters and Israeli soldiers.
All right, thanks a lot, Mona Candil, joining us from Ramallah. Elsewhere, Iran's foreign minister says Washington has taken some steps towards giving guarantees to Tehran as part of efforts to revive the 2015 deal. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the revelation during an interview with American media outlet National Public Radio. The top Iranian diplomat underlined that the issue of guarantees is of great importance for Tehran that can pave the way for a sustainable agreement. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Since last year, Iran and the remaining signatories have held several rounds of talks to revive the deal. Iran is seeking U.S. guarantees that it will never again pull out of the deal. Tehran is also calling for the resolution of the safeguards issues with the U.N. nuclear agency in a bid to revive the agreement. London police have released images of 13 suspects involved in violence during a recent protest outside the Iranian embassy over the death of Mahsa Amini. The Met police called the violence unacceptable and vowed to trace the culprits who had obvious intent to cause injury. 5 police officers were seriously injured in clashes with protesters. 12 people were arrested during the disorder. Meanwhile, London's mayor, Sadiq Khan, denounced acts of violence by the protesters outside the Iranian embassy on Sunday. Khan said attacks on the police and communities will never be tolerated. The mayor said a, quote, selfish minority who attempted to hijack the protests must be brought to justice. The head of Britain's opposition Labour Party has blamed Prime Minister Liz Truss for losing control over the country's economy. Addressing the party's annual conference, Keir Starmer slammed the new government's economic policies. He also said that his party is ready to steer the country out of the current economic turmoil. The remarks came just days after a tax slashing plan by the government sparked criticism. The plan proposes a cut in taxes, including for the highest earners. The revelation also saw the British pound plunging to an unprecedented low against the dollar.
The British pound takes a pounding yet again, only days after the country's finance minister announced the biggest tax-cutting package in decades, all funded by borrowing at a time of high inflation. They termed it a mini-budget, but it was a mega shift in direction. The Chancellor confirmed the government would implement Prime Minister Liz Truss's leadership campaign pledges to reverse the national insurance rise, cancel the corporation tax rise, and a surprise new tax cut for the highest earners.
Take the additional rate of income tax. At 45%, it is currently higher than the headline top rate in G7 countries like the US and Italy. And it is even higher than social democracies like Norway. But I'm not going to cut the additional rate of tax today, Mr. Speaker. I'm going to abolish it altogether.
Ordinary Britons may not think about exchange rates on a daily basis, but a fall in the pound will affect their day-to-day.
Britain imports nearly half of its foodstuffs, and therefore the pound gets weaker, the cost of that, those basic foodstuffs goes up dramatically. And so anything which is coming in will be hitting inflation at a time when you don't want to have that. The only good news part of actually of this would be actually your exports are now better value. The trouble is if the global demand is shrinking, therefore the demand for those exports would also be shrinking.
There are also concerns about a long recession as winter looms with no end in sight to the energy crisis or the war in Ukraine. Online, calls for a general election are gaining traction. And in the Conservative Party itself, rumors about a no-confidence vote in the brand new Prime Minister.
Some experts say the UK's central bank, the Bank of England, could intervene to halt the pound sliding. Many others are saying the government's decision to borrow its way out of the current situation could end in tears. Saeed Burizup, London.
Well, with less than a week ahead of a presidential election in Brazil, a new poll shows frontrunner Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has further widened his lead over incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. The survey puts support for Lula at 46% in the first round of voting against 33% for Bolsonaro. The leftist leader has also boosted his lead to a 14-point advantage in a potential runoff. However, recent polls indicate Lula could beat his far-right populist rival in the first round on October the 2nd. Lula rose from destitute poverty to become the most popular president in Brazilian history. He ruled the country between 2003 and 2010, but fell from grace when he was jailed on alleged corruption charges. But now he is on the cusp of a remarkable comeback, as Bolsonaro has lost much of his popularity due to his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic and the economy. Lebanese workers and depositors tried to storm the parliament compound on Monday amid the country's economic crisis. Retired military personnel demanded better monthly pay, while depositors called on the banks to release their life savings. Our correspondent Mariam Salah has more from Beirut.
The crisis hit Lebanon is once again a scene of angry masses. The parliament is back to meet and debate a new budget. Yet protesters see the budget being discussed as elusive.
Instead of putting together a budget which encourages development in agriculture, industrial production and all fields in Lebanon, they want to impoverish the people and push them to die in the sea as they immigrate illegally. The government which relies on debt is being controlled by a mob, which is the Banks Association and the Central Bank. They should be held accountable for getting billions of dollars out of the country.
Banks reopened partially on Monday following a week-long closure in the wake of a wave of holdups. Depositors stormed at least 7 bank branches in the capital and abroad demanding their trapped savings.
We know these banks, you know, where we invested our money. But unfortunately, they stole the money between themselves, and they plan, and every time they create a story.
One woman named Sally Hafez forced one branch to give her $13,000 of her savings, saying she needed it to pay for her sister's medical treatment. But she didn't take back her money on her own.
They left us no other choice. We encouraged Sally, and we were with her when she held up the bank, because it was a humanitarian situation, and we will be with all the people who urgently need their money. Our government is rotten and corrupt, and so is the judicial system.
A former member of parliament tells Press TV that the government has been procrastinating while time is running out. The governmental institutions, including schools, are almost out of service.
The entire governmental sector is paralyzed. The workers, the military personnel, the ministerial workers, the public teachers, they all have rights and they can barely do their job. There's no health care, no educational assistance. The budget plan the parliament is debating today is unfair.
Lebanon's economic downfall began in October 2019. The Lebanese pound has lost around 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar, but officials have failed to put in place necessary reforms. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. New British Prime Minister Liz Truss faces hard times as the UK economy is at the risk of recession. Experts say UK economic woes deepened in September as falling business activity indicates that the economy is likely in recession. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world outlets for further details. Stay tuned, please. Reuters wrote, the downturn in British businesses steepened this month as they battle soaring cost and faltering demand, according to a survey that hammered home the rising risk of recession. Released just as Finance Minister Kwasi Kwarteng was due to flesh out the economic agenda of new Prime Minister Liz Truss, the S&P Global CIPS Flash Composite Purchasing Managers Index, PMI, fell to 48.4 from 49.6 in August. It marked the lowest reading since the COVID-19 lockdown of January last year. A Reuters poll of economists had pointed to a reading of 49. Any reading below 50 marks a contraction in activity. The PMI is likely to raise new questions about the health of Britain's economy after consumer confidence fell this month to the lowest level since records began in 1974, according to a survey published recently. Chris Williamson, chief business economist at S&P Global, said UK economic woes deepened in September as falling business activity indicates that the economy is likely in recession. He said the survey's forward-looking gauges suggested worse is to come in the final month of 2022. The PMI's gauge of future output fell to its lowest since May 2020, when Britain was in the grip of its first COVID-19 lockdown. Activity contracted in both the manufacturing and services industries. The PMI for the services sector fell to 49.2 in September from 50.9 in August, the weakest reading since January 2021. While the manufacturing PMI rose to 48.5 from 47.3, much of the improvement reflected a worsening supply chain of performance, which in normal times reflects shortages due to strong demand, but not this time. S&P Global said firms often mentioned reducing output volumes due to weaker intakes of new business, though there were also reports that input shortages, particularly electronics, had constrained production at some units. Despite the pound falling to 37-year lows against the dollar, export orders contracted in both the manufacturing and service sectors, S&P Global said. Also, the website of RT reported the Eurozone's economic downturn deepened in September, with business activity contracting for a third consecutive month, a new survey by S&P Global showed. The report found that manufacturers across the 19-country union were hit hard by a skyrocketing energy cost, with the Purchasing Managers Index, PMI, sinking to its lowest level since 2013. The PMI, which is seen as a good gauge of overall economic health, fell from 48.9 in August to 48.2 in September. Surging energy prices and the rising cost of living are not only hitting demand, but also limiting manufacturing production and service sector activity in some cases, S&P Global economist Chris Williamson said in a statement seen by Bloomberg. Williamson warned a Eurozone recession is on the cards, noting Germany is facing the toughest conditions with the economy deteriorating at a rate not seen outside of pandemic since the global financial crisis. Overall demand in the Eurozone plunged to its lowest mark since November 2020, when the continent was in the grips of the second wave of the COVID pandemic. The Business Expectations Index also declined, slipping to 53.8 from last month's 56.6, its lowest reading since May 2020. S&P Global expects the euro area's economy to shrink by 0.1% in the third quarter.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Tensions are ratcheting up between Turkey and Greece once again over two Aegean islands near the Turkish coast. But a quick history check shows that Greece and Turkey, which are both part of NATO, have feuded for years over maritime borders and energy exploration rights in the Aegean and East Mediterranean seas. In this edition of the program, we will look at whether this crisis between the two can escalate into a possible military confrontation or not, and how this will affect the Eastern Mediterranean region as a whole. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Historian, political analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos joins us from London. Also joining us, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at Istanbul Bilgi University, İlter Turan, joins us from Istanbul.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. So let me first start with you, Marcus Papadopoulos, and taking a look at this crisis at the present time that has the two heating up again against each other. Greece deploying U.S. armored vehicles on these two islands, and the ships are loaded with what is said to be U.S. armored vehicles. First question that comes up is, why is Greece deploying these vehicles onto the two islands?
Well, let it be said that the terrible level of tension which exists between Turkey and Greece, coupled with the pure hatred in existence between the two countries, is a profound demonstration of NATO disunity. It is also a profound demonstration of why, when NATO leaders claim that the Western military bloc is unified, they are lying, because NATO is full of divisions. There is great tension between Turkey and Bulgaria, there is tension between Hungary and Romania, and there is tension between Bulgaria and North Macedonia. But turn into the crisis in the Aegean Sea. Erdogan, like his predecessors, is threatening the independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of Greece. Greece is a member of the United Nations, and its borders are internationally recognized. Secondly, Erdogan, again like his predecessors, is pursuing a greater Turkey, like how a greater Albania is being pursued in the Balkans. And thirdly, Erdogan, in threatening the status quo in the Aegean Sea, is effectively undermining the Treaty of Lausanne of 1923, because the Treaty of Lausanne underpins the status quo in the Aegean Sea.
Sure. Do you agree with our guest there, İlter Turan?
I don't know where to start from, but let me say that this
this unity of NATO, which the gentleman has referred to, is of course true, but then NATO was established for a specific purpose, which did not preclude disagreement among its members. In fact, we had some actual fighting as NATO was an anti-Soviet bloc treaty. We had fighting among allies, namely, this is always the case. In fact, is the reason why NATO was formed declines in importance, there is a greater tendency among its members to fall into disagreements. Now, I was fascinated by the gentleman's giving examples of how there are differences between allies, and he referred to a disagreement between Bulgaria and Turkey. I'm not aware of it, but I'm aware of a number of bad relations Greece has with its neighbors, but I will not go into that. I think the question of having weapons on these islands puts the argument that national sovereignty is about international law. And about
well, let me jump in and quickly, if you don't mind. I just want to ask you, before you continue, I want to ask you, is what has happened legal or not?
It is illegal. There's no question about that. I mean, you know, according to the treaties of both Lausanne and Paris, Greece is not permitted to arm these islands. Now, the reason Greece is presumably arming these islands is because it is its sovereign right. If we buy that argument, then international agreements have no meaning. And also, let me make one final observation. The gentleman suggested that a number of countries in the region were expansionist. There is really one truly expansionist country in the region, and that is Greece itself. Just look at the map of Greece after wars and what has happened, and it has constantly kept expanding. You look at Turkey after it was founded as a republic, and there is no expansion with the exception of a couple of international agreements. So if there is an expansionary power to be identified in the region, everybody knows who that is.
Marcus Papadopoulos, so is Greece expansionary or Turkey?
What you have just heard from the guest in Istanbul is an inversion of the truth. It is absolutely preposterous to claim that Greece is an expansionist country. Let us look at the facts. Turkey illegally occupies a part of the Republic of Cyprus. Turkey illegally occupies a part of Syria. Turkey, at its will, supported by both America and Britain, invades northern Iraq when it chooses to. Furthermore, it is not Greece which is calling into question Turkey's territorial integrity in accordance with the Treaty of Lausanne. It is Turkey which is doing so. So, quite frankly, the guest in Istanbul does not have a legal or political leg to stand on. And we have to address the reasons as to why Greece is has deployed military hardware to the islands in question, because Erdogan is making territorial claims against them. The Treaty of Lausanne stipulates that Greece must not establish naval bases on those islands, and Athens has not done so.
Very well. But so that's a point that we need our guests to address, because that is what the agreement specified, isn't it? That you basically are banned from building naval bases or fortifications on these islands, in this particular case, Lesbos and Samos. Isn't that true?
Apparently, the gentleman is very selective about the reading of the treaty. Actually, Greece is allowed to have law enforcement forces on the island, but nothing else, no military figures. So, but then, let me turn back to some of the allegations the gentleman has felt fully free to volunteer. Of course, it may have escaped the gentleman's attention that the Turkish presence in Syria and in Iraq is not one of claiming that this is Turkish territory. It's not incorporating that, but it is according to the Adana Accords that Turkish forces are in Syria, and it is again according to agreements with the Iraqi government in 1998 that the Turkish forces are in northern Iraq. And the moment the particular reason why they're there is gone, Turkey has no claims on the territory of these countries. So I think this is imaginary. With Cyprus, I guess the gentleman has forgotten that the conditions under which Turkey intervened on Cyprus. First of all, it's not Greece, incidentally. Let's make that clear. It's not Greece, but it was a military takeover engineered by the Greek government that was that essentially warranted mm-hmm. Turkish intervention on the island. And Turks were being literally ethnically cleansed so that this intervention was okay. to stop ethnic cleansing.
I think our guest wants to say something in reaction to your statements. Go ahead, Marcus.
Indeed. Turkey is a guarantor, or was a guarantor, of the Republic of Cyprus prior to its invasion of the island in July of 1974. So there were two stages in the Turkish invasion. Attila I effectively put a stop to the coup in Nicosia. That effectively also brought down the military regime in Athens. So therefore, Attila I restored the status quo to the Republic of Cyprus. So why did Turkey then, in August of 1974, launch Attila II when the status quo had already been restored by Attila I? I put that to the gentleman in Istanbul.
Okay, a quick response, because we've got to move beyond this, because there are other areas of friction and crises between the two that involve a lot of other countries at the same time. Go ahead.
Gentleman has forgotten the fact that Turks were being killed right and left on the island. So that's all I've got to say.
Can you explain Attila II?
All right, let's move on. This is what's interesting here. And Iltar, let me address this to you. Iltar Turan, if I may. You're having Turkey react to what has occurred because you have hardware that was donated by Washington, which is said to be, let me read here, 23 and 18 vehicles respectively, donated to Athens. Now, I'm looking at 41 vehicles. I don't think anybody in the right mind would just donate 41 vehicles. What is the purpose behind the U.S. donating these vehicles to Greece?
Well, you have to ask that question to the Americans. Apparently, I mean, they're ostensible reason is that they are setting up a defense line against Russian expansion, which they find is threatening. And because it is difficult to access the Black Sea through Turkey, because the Montreux Convention does not give foreign warships the liberty of moving in and out of the Black Sea, this sort of Greece, Bulgaria, Romania connection is presumably a way into the Black Sea. But it also appears that the United States is setting up a second line of defense because it doesn't think it can rely on Turkey for NATO purposes sufficiently. And Greece has been made into a depot of U.S. armaments. They're increasing on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And I think because of this changed American position, Greeks have come under the illusion that somehow the United States is ready to defend them. Obviously, great states don't let small states to lead them into conflicts. And it is always important to remember that.
All right, so let's move on here to oil and gas explorations. Marcus, we only have another 12 minutes, even less, but this whole thing is so wide, and the number of countries that are involved are so many when you really dig into this. What are we looking at? We know both Turkey and Greece, they're in a race to develop these energy resources in the Eastern Mediterranean. but they're on separate sides. Where are we going with that, if you can tell us, and what's legal and illegal when it comes to oil explorations in terms of who has the right and who doesn't?
Well, America doesn't favor Greece over Turkey. Indeed, historically, America has favored Turkey over Greece. Why? Because Turkey is of immense geostrategic importance to Washington. And the reason as to why the Americans have supplied the Greek armed forces with these vehicles, which Athens has now deployed to the islands in the Aegean Sea, is because of Erdogan. Firstly, America has
but
a problematic
relationship. Aren't they both NATO members? I mean, if they're NATO members, they shouldn't work off each other. I guess that goes back to your division statement, right?
Yes, absolutely. NATO is not unified. NATO is a very divided military bloc. But this is all aimed at Erdogan. Firstly, America has a problematic relationship with Erdogan, not with the Turkish state, not with the Turkish establishment, but with Erdogan. So the Americans are sending a message to Erdogan by giving the Greek army.
Okay, I got to get a reaction from our guest in Istanbul.
Well, it's about
Russia. Do you agree, Ilter Tunar? Do you agree with our guest there?
I'm curious about this explanation reduced down to a person who happens to be the president of Turkey at this time. I'm not an admirer of him, mind you, but I have seen no indication that his government has any plans to invade any Greek island. And there is no feeling in Turkey that they want to invade a neighboring our country's territory. This is entirely false. And, you know, interestingly,
which was put to you.
Let me just say that for the most part, many Turks feel Erdogan was more an American creation. So as to why they are trying to stop him now, if that is the case, would be a very interesting question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we got to dig into this oil and gas exploration because that has been brought up to a point where there have been other countries involved, because I'm going to skip as to the legality or the illegality, but, you know, this involves a number of countries. We're looking at Cyprus. We're looking at France to have gotten involved. We're looking at the possible military aspect to this. Back in 2020 is when there was really points where you had Rafale jets from France, Marcus, that were flown into that area where there were really heated exchanges. What are we looking at when it comes to that? Because it's not getting resolved, obviously.
The Americans have gathered their allies in the region in what I describe as an Eastern Mediterranean gathering involving Greece, Cyprus, Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, and of course Britain and France, together naturally with America, because there are vast reserves of oil and gas there. And of course, the Americans ultimately want to secure that for themselves. And they will do that by their Eastern Mediterranean gathering. That is another reason as to why I have long contended that American supremacy in West Asia is not on the way out. It is not eroding. If anything, it has been boosted by gathering Washington's friends and allies in the region. But Turkey has not been included. Why? Not because of Turkey per se, but because Erdogan is not playing ball, so to speak, especially when it concerns Russia. Erdogan is intensifying Turkey's economic relationship with Russia, and that is to great annoyance and to great fury of policymakers in Washington. Mm-hmm. So again, that is why the Americans have supplied the Greek armed forces with this weaponry. It's a message to Erdogan, not to Turkey, to Erdogan.
Ilter Turan, a Turkey publication and media organization that's very well known, has ran this headline where experts believe Greece's increasing violations of Turkish airspace is part of an agenda that's been encouraged by the West to corner Turkey for taking an independent foreign policy. That in particular obviously falls squarely on Erdogan and his stance. Do you agree with that or not?
But actually, I don't agree with that, because when we look at the history of the relations, such allegations have been there all along. The gentleman in London introduced the Russian equation to the discussion, and you know, Turkish-Russian relations got on the road to improvement ever since the end of the Soviet Union. It's nothing new. So I think this is one thing. Secondly, the argument that this area is blessed with immense amount of natural resources is still something that waits to be proven. In fact, the gentleman's attention may have been away when the United States decided that the idea of building a pipeline, for example, was simply uneconomical. And that is why there are current discussions between Israel and Turkey with regard to whether it would not be possible to connect the Israeli gas to the Turkish pipeline system. So, you know, the critical thing is that this sort of economic zone discussions are political. They need to be political. All the riparian countries need to be incorporated into a discussion. It's not that you could organize some against the others. You have to get them all if you want stability and peace and prosperous exploitation of resources.
Okay. Well, we need to expand more on why you have chosen Erdogan and separated him, Marcus Papadopoulos, from the Turkey equation, because that's very interesting, because you have the way that either coming from Turkey or otherwise, that Erdogan is purely trying to be separated from Turkey, and he's the one that they want to corner. Are they going to be successful in doing that? Because you can't separate, you know, him from Turkey at this point anyways.
The Americans are masters in understanding and having the capabilities to manage difficult relationships. There have been times in the past when American allies and friends have leaders who have been problematic to Washington, but Washington knows that Turkey will always be a staunch friend and ally to America. Turkey will always be in existence, but Erdogan will not always be in existence. That is why the Americans know that their strategic partnership with Turkey is as firm as it has ever been before. There is no tension between the American and Turkish establishments, but for the Americans, they are having problems with Erdogan. Like how okay. There is no tension between the Israeli and Turkish establishments. There is tension between the Israeli establishment and Erdogan.
Thank you very much for that, Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author from London. And Ilter Turan from Istanbul, thank you. Emeritus Professor of Political Science at Istanbul Bilgi University. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavoy and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Now, we find that Imam Musa al-Kazim's life, in all of its various dimensions, is distinguished in a few things. First of all, he is distinguished in the firmness and the strength for which he stood up for when it came to the right, to truth, to haq. We also find his steadfastness in front of all kinds of events, trials and tribulations, good or bad. And we also see Imam Musa al-Kazim's luminous behavior, his actions, his morals, and his ethics, of which no deviation or crookedness has ever been reported. And finally, the life of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam is marked by balance. It is in harmony with that of the life of the Prophet Muhammad. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام الصنيعة لا تتم صنيعة عند المؤمن لصاحبها إلا بثلاثة أشياء: تصغيرها وسترها وتعجيلها. فمن صغر الصنيعة عند المؤمن فقد عظم أخاه، ومن عظم الصنيعة عنده فقد صغر أخاه، ومن كتم ما أولاه من صنيعه فقد كرم فعاله، ومن عجل ما وعد فقد هنئ العطية.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, "A good turn done to a fellow believer is not considered complete until accompanied by three things: underestimation of the act, concealing it, and hastening its completion. He who underestimates his good turn to a fellow believer has esteemed his brother highly indeed, whereas he who esteems his good turn to be great has deemed his brother to be insignificant. He who conceals the good turn that he has done has honored his action, and he who hastens to fulfill his promise takes pleasure in the gift too."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Now, these dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, even though they might seem short and sweet, very brief, but in reality the meaning and the wisdom behind them is not only something that has surpassed age and time, but the profoundness of the wisdom is so great that it truly can encompass the cosmos. Now, one such instance we want to talk about in this segment is that Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam, in his dialogue with his companions, said that the soul has to be admonished. And so here Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam said to the companion, whoever has no admonisher of his own soul, his enemy, Shaitan, has power over him. So here we're talking about, first and foremost, one's own soul, and we are also talking about an admonisher of your own soul. Now, really, this is such a beautiful statement because, for example, we have two situations. One situation is where we ourselves are the admonisher and the reprimander and the one who keeps in check our own soul. The other situation is when we don't have an admonisher on our own soul, when we don't keep a check, we don't keep watch over, we don't reprimand, we don't guard our own soul. Now, in the second situation, when somebody is not guarding their own soul, then of course, Shaitan will come and influence them and instigate them towards doing all kinds of sins. And if one does not admonish and keep their own soul under control, then of course, as Imam Al-Kadhim says, Shaitan will have power over that individual. But on the other hand, we had the first scenario, the first condition or situation in which we do guard our own soul. We do keep an eye on our own soul. We do reprimand and admonish our own soul. In this situation, it is much more difficult for Shaitan to come and overpower us. Why? Because we are constantly keeping a watch over our actions, over our thoughts, and over our souls in order to protect our soul and ourselves from the disobedience to the Almighty Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Imam Al-Kadhim is famous for this particular emphasis during his time. What he wanted to do was he saw there was a great deal of moral corruption. There was attachment to this world. The Abbasid caliphs were engrossed in the materialistic possessions of this world. They were drinking intoxicants. They were spending their time illegitimately with women. They were spreading fahisha and fahsha. And Imam alayhi salam rose to the challenge to correct this type of actions that were there and to spread these important teachings which highlight the need